Well, lots to talk about with Jeff Grupp, his return to Coast to Coast, as we talk about the law of attraction and secret agendas. His works, of course, The Telescreen, Corporatism, and Telemation, and so much more. We'll be back with Jeff in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we've got Jeff Grupp back at Coast to Coast AM. He's a former college teacher, and he's taught at a number of university-level schools all over the country. He taught philosophy, and specifically Eastern philosophy, ethics, metaphysics, and Buddhism. Here's Jeff back on Coast to Coast AM. Jeff, welcome. How are you?
I'm great, George. How about you?
Likewise. Everything's fine. Tell me a little bit about Eastern philosophy. What is that?
Great question, George. Actually, I still am teaching these days here in the Ann Arbor area. But Eastern philosophy is, that's my specialization that I teach in. And in a number of ways you can think about it, take Zen Buddhism, for example. That's the one of the Chinese versions of Buddhism. In a lot of ways you can consider it, this is an interesting way to put it, you can consider it to be the exact opposite of Western culture. So take any basic general principle of what Western culture practices, believes in, exhibits behaviorally, or whatever, Zen Buddhism will be the exact opposite. They have a saying in Zen Buddhism that says, don't just do something, stand there. So they're playing off this. In Zen Buddhism, for example, the idea is to sit and do nothing, where in our culture, the idea is to either occupy yourself with some addiction or a hobby or maybe a job or something, or sit and watch maybe a lot of TV or something. So in Zen Buddhism, they want to clear the mind. So it's really a lifestyle. It's very popular these days in America, but very, very few people have the ability to really get into it, unfortunately, because there's so much undoing of, you know, what culture's taught you. You remember Yoda in The Empire Strikes Back saying you have to unlearn what you have learned? That really could not be more true for what somebody has to do in Zen Buddhism, for example. But Eastern religion overall is often devoid of an idea of a creator God, but instead they'll hold a similar idea. They'll assert that there's an omnipresent light that is responsible for being the actual reality that creates all the sort of illusory forms, and to contact that through meditation is perfect satisfaction. And sometimes they use the word bliss. It's not a very good word. It's just a state of happiness that really can't be describable in words, and it really is attainable. It's not really even that difficult to get to it. You just have to set aside all the things that culture gives us and take some time every day, maybe a couple hours for the proper meditations, and you really will change yourself and get into their nirvana or whatever words you want to use. And these are very positive. It fills you with love and incredible, really searing compassion for other people, and it's just enormously positive. I know a lot of people around are saying, Buddhism, for example, is Satanism. And if I'm an example of somebody who can speak for Buddhism, that is simply not true. There are dangers in religions, whether it's Christianity or Buddhism, where you can get off the track a little bit and really fall into dark paths, like some of the stuff we might discuss tonight and what I call dark ecstasy. But following Buddhism in a straightforward way is really, in a lot of ways, exactly what our culture needs. And you can remain a Christian or an atheist or whatever you want to be. Buddhism doesn't really conflict with any of those. Hinduism does in some ways a little bit, so Buddhism's a better example. But it brings peace and skeptical thinking and incredible kindness, and it's really just a wonderful set of religions over there, I'd say.
Can you say that Eastern philosophy, Jeff, is better than Western philosophy? Is there a right and wrong?
I definitely do not hold that one is better than the other. They're very different, but on the other hand, they're extraordinarily similar, as I think I discussed real briefly the last time I was on the show. But no, I don't hold that that's the case. I think really in a lot of ways, they're just talking about the same things in different words. You know, as we were saying last time, you know, if Buddhists talk about an omnipresent light, you know, infinite light everywhere called nirvana, well, Christianity talks about an omnipresent light everywhere called God. So, you know, they're really not very different. In fact, I think they're almost identical in many ways. So they're both just, I hold, George, that the religions are much, much superior more superior than sciences, even in their pure state, not the, you know, sort of the corrupted big money science idea, but even in their pure state, the religions seem to have a better track record. They're more verifiable empirically. They go a lot better with conspiracy theory, which is really interesting, because, of course, you know, conspiracy theory, I think, is much more empirically verifiable than the typical models of history and science and so forth that we have. So I think they complement each other. I mean, if you mixed, say, Christianity and Buddhism, that you've really got a good view of the world, because I think Christianity gives us a lot better history than we can get really in our universities or in any of the other religions. But then again, Buddhism has the most wonderful meditation techniques that really I think Jesus was probably trying to get at. I don't know. Maybe there's some missing verses or something in the Bible.
A lot missing.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think the best way to look at them is to see how they bolster each other, I'd say.
And the last time you were with us, and we got to the point where we talked about dark ecstasy, we didn't talk about it in detail. Tell me a little bit more about this, because I was just starting to understand it and you were gone. What is that?
Okay, yeah, this is, I allege that whether you're a conspiracy theorist or not, if you really want to understand this confusing world, dark ecstasy is the way to do it. In a quick summary of what it is, it's just a state of achieving almost a physiological euphoria, a real mental bliss off of acts of utter inversion. That's a nice way of saying, you know, dark sadomasochism, real murderous sadomasochism, or suicidal nihilism, or, you know, just the human sacrifice, the real dark stuff out there. And this is a mental state that exists in all people. And we can sort of verify that. I mean, if you believe there's a secret government or an Illuminati, I mean, it's kind of easy to verify that those exist. For, you know, for example, the CIA controls the U.S. government in many, many ways. They tell Bush something, and Bush has his whole presidency, you know, in response to what the CIA tells him. So in a sense, the CIA is controlling him. You know, lobbyists and think tanks control the government. And, you know, so it's real easy to, if you're denying that there's a secret government behind the governments of the world, you're really not being empirical, because it's extremely easy to verify. And we can also verify that dark government is very, very sinister, because what's the evidence for that? Just look at the world. The world that they're engineering, social engineering, is extremely horrific. I mean, if they're so smart, how come the world is filled with war, poverty, you know, there's destitution absolutely everywhere. So it's really not a pretty picture. Now, to verify that the group, you know, conspiracy theorists sort of fall into two camps here. Some of them stop right where we just left off right there, saying, okay, there's a secret government, it's composed of people, and they're very, very evil in some ways. Then there's, you know, the other sort of other half of conspiracy theorists, what they do is they say, no, let's go a little further. They're not even people anymore. They're aliens or transdimensional beings or sort of maybe satanic Nephilim type of beings that are discussed in the Bible and so forth. And it seems to me that this is where you get into the dark ecstasy issue. Especially when you talk about the second group there. I think that it's kind of tricky. You know, a lot of people talk about the second sort, you know, the really non-human entities controlling the secret government,
right,
which is easy to verify. But to really say, is there, you know, if somebody says, how can you prove that there's a non-human secret government, that's a little tricky to do. And the only way I know how to prove that is by using actually some of my own personal meditations and Buddhism and so forth. You know, when you get to this level, it's hard to point to something in the world. You're almost leaving empirical science and going to different kinds of proofs, like philosophical proofs or whatnot. But in my personal work in Buddhism, I mean, I can see, and anybody can do this work, you can see that there's an omnipresent benevolence, you know, sort of all-loving creative force everywhere inside of everything and behind everything, creating everything. So, I mean, some of you may believe that, some people listening may not. You have to sort of make your decision of whether or not you want to go with what I'm saying here or not. But if you do, then this has extraordinary ramifications, such as one being, well, if there's an all-loving creative force behind everything, then why is there so much darkness in the world?
And hatred and evil and everything else. How come?
Yeah, and that's a huge, huge mystery. And one idea is that there is another set of beings out there Some people call them Nephilim or Greys, you know, whatever. They just take some super advanced type of beings that are much more advanced than humans that had enough power that they could alter the course of things, sort of, you know, the course of the way that the omnipresent creator, if one exists, you know, if you go in that direction, it could change their course of events and impose evil into the system. And if such a group exists, I feel all this checks out, and they could then, therefore, manipulate our world. They could, for example, impose very dark feelings inside humans. You know, some of the, you know, when you see soldiers in sort of a war frenzy, mm-hmm. or, you know, you hear about sadomasochistic rituals, you hear about serial killers who report to developing literally a high. They get high off of doing their crazy dissection rituals and so forth. You know, and then let's take it down a couple notches. Take just ordinary human behavior. This isn't really what we're going to call dark ecstasy, but why do Americans get so frenzied off of these crazy football hits? I mean, these are ultra-violent football hits that happen often in games. I'm not knocking football, you know, great if you like it, nothing, no offense to you or anything, but it's just an interesting phenomenon. You can have, you know, the whole crowd seated, and then one supermassive hit makes everybody get to their feet and scream. I mean, yeah, why don't people act the same way towards pizza, for example? I mean, sometimes maybe some people will get off the couch and yell, "Yay, my pizza's here," or whatever. But, I mean, there's just such a frenzy involved with violence. It's just, if you sit back and, I mean, we're kind of used to this, and so therefore we don't really think much about it because it's so, you know, commonplace for us. But if you sit back from the bird's eye view, pretend you're an alien just coming to Earth and just observing this behavior, you'd think it's kind of strange that of all the things we could get so excited about, you know, the supermassive hockey hits, the soccer riots, the football hits, like we were saying, so many. I mean, have you ever seen the soccer riots, George, where the weird, bizarre things happen? Like you'll have the fans will. I mean, these crazy riots.
Well, they get killed. They get crushed.
People die. Yeah. They attack players. I mean, they attack players on the teams in strange ways. Like they won't beat up a guy. Instead, they'll take off all his clothes, so he has to run around naked or something. I mean, bizarre.
The poor people at the bottom get crushed. I mean, it's horrible.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's not really dark ecstasy. It's sort of just a symptom of what's down there deep. And so what dark ecstasy is then is for some reason, humans have a capacity within them to experience a high of some sort off of sheer dark acts and so forth. It's almost as if what's happening, see, you have to think about the example, George, where you have, you know, say you prick your finger or something and it hurts really bad and you stare right at the pain, you feel it as deeply as possible. And when you do that, the pain sort of vanishes and goes away. Now, you have to imagine that little experiment times maybe 1,000 or something.
Sure.
And what you have is a scenario where you can alter through certain little meditations like that, or they can get more extreme in different forms, where the body can be released from pain. And that's a really interesting scenario. This is heavily related to sadomasochism, if you can't tell. The idea is then that you sort of have a joyful release. You know, a lot of the fears of life go away. A lot of our lives, our behavior is ordered around making sure we don't have certain pains in our life and ordering our feelings just to be a certain way so that we minimize pain. Imagine being freed from all of that and having an altered mental state where pain really didn't ensue in your life. And that would be, you can probably imagine you'd be quite elated in some ways. But this is just another phenomenon in this idea of dark ecstasy that persons who can do certain kind of meditations can eradicate basically all physical or mental pain from their lives, but at the same time, they can seek out those pains because the act of putting themselves in pain or others in pain and not feeling it is in itself the escape, is the release, is the freedom. So, interestingly, in these states of what we call dark ecstasy, a person may in fact seek out tremendous pain and so forth because it sort of gives them their freedom. So these are just a taste of how things can get so incredibly inverted in this mental state. It's very hard to verify for someone who's not been in this state that it exists. Again, as I said last time I was on, the only reason I know that it exists is because I fell into it by accident in the late 1990s. I still don't really know how it happened, if you want the truth, George. I know it's somehow associated with my interest in practicing religion and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I'm still not exactly sure what happened. I was extremely obsessed with evolutionary theory and atheism and basically all the philosophies that I've abandoned now. And somehow...
What do you mean by you abandoned them? What happened?
Well, I used to be an atheist and evolutionist and a fatalist, and I used to hold basically just mainstream ideas. They're really not very unusual ideas, but I was very heavily into those, in which I no longer am now, for actually empirical reasons. I think there's evidence to turn your back on atheism. I think, as we discussed on the last show, I think there's evidence that God exists. Evolution, I think, that's a tricky philosophy. There's several reasons to claim that there's absolutely no evidence for evolutionary theory. Mm-hmm. There are problems with the fossil relics that don't exist. You know, we don't have the missing link. But right. It's much more extreme than that. There's very few fossil relics at all. And a lot of the fossil relics that do exist, scientists have been fighting with each other for sometimes 40 or 50 years. They're all broken up. They try to piece them back together, and they're arguing with each other how to do it. And then when you put it back together, it looks a lot like a baboon. And I think Michael Cremo, who's on your show a lot, got a lot of this in his book, Forbidden Archaeology. And, you know, we could go on a real good example of why evolutionary theory, the idea that we came from animals, is problematical, is the fact that, well, when Darwin first introduced a lot of the ideas, he introduced the idea of natural selection. You know, the certain traits get passed on through reproduction, and whatever traits are most suited to the environment are the ones that continue on. So if there's a drought, and then the strongest wolves are the ones that are able to have enough strength in their weak state of the drought, and they can catch the rabbit. So the strongest ones survive. That trait goes on. Now, that's all fine theoretically, but a little problem happened in the 1970s. Scientists changed their mind and said that evolution doesn't happen gradually. You know, where over a long period of time, the deer changes into a horse. They said, no, everything happens almost, so to speak, instantaneously. So we'll have a million years of horses and then bam, a million years of deer and then bam, all of a sudden there's horses. There's no real transition point. They call it punctuated equilibrium is the name of the theory. But I think what scientists didn't realize is that's a huge problem for evolutionary theory, because you previously had a mechanism called natural selection, which required gradualism, you know, gradual changes. So if you're going to change your theory from gradual transformations of species into instant ones, then all of a sudden your mechanism, your engine behind evolution is gone. Natural selection doesn't work anymore. The whole theory just is really kind of a mess in a lot of ways if you think about it. And a lot of times they'll come along and say, well, we can have, you know, radiation or something can cause mutations, and that will lead to quick changes in species. That is absolutely a theoretical disaster right there. Why is it? Because, George, tell me how you can have, imagine two deer next to each other on a savanna undergoing a mutation. Okay, so they're going to transform, be on the road to somehow transforming into horses, whether partially or...
Hold on for a second, Jeff. We're going to take this quick break. We'll come back and talk more, especially about telementation, the law of attraction. Become a Coast Insider. Join the club for less than 25 cents a day. Want to find out all about it? Simply go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, Jeff Grupp with us. Jeff, I think you've touched on something in your work, telementation, where you talk about the feeling mass, the law of attraction. Let's spend a little time on that here. We have regularly conducted mass experiments hoping to do things for the good. We're trying one right now, hoping that we can get a deluge over Texas and put out some of these wildfires that they've had. Tell me about telementation. How'd you come up with the word, and what's it mean?
Those are interesting experiments that you have going as well. I've followed some of those. The feeling mass is described heavily in my book, Telementation. Telementation is the idea that a deep feeling state inside you can alter reality in ways that you want. you know, such as change, make your relationships better, make your bank account bigger, and so forth. It's similar to the law of attraction, but a little bit different. But the feeling mass is a specific reference to a feeling state you have inside of you that's responsible for doing this. And it's very easy and very difficult at the same time, sort of, to locate within you. If you can locate it within you, you can carry out telemeditation with incredible success. And this is, again, what my book tries to describe in as much detail as possible, sort of try to give an instruction manual on how to do it. But the feeling mass is almost, let me explain it this way. It's like we have two feeling streams within us. And one is our surface feelings, you know, boredom, happiness, whatever. They just change from moment to moment. And then there's a second one that's below those, which is unchanging. So the surfacey one has changing forms, and then the one underneath those has a constant structure. And it's almost like a super energetic hum or vibration in you, almost like when you first locate it, it's almost like a great tension of some sort, which can feel sort of, you know, I don't know how to explain it, maybe make you feel, kind of like that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it feels good. And what I would suggest, as I try to describe in the book, here's what I would suggest to listeners. What you want to do is take some time to every day, maybe take 15 minutes or something, or maybe twice a day, and just look at all your feelings. Feel them. Notice how they flow, what their structures are, how they come and go, and really get in touch with those. Do that a little bit more. And day after day, when you do that, you'll eventually come to a point where you notice deeper states of feeling, and maybe even sort of states behind the surfacey feelings. And you'll see that the deeper states of feeling are more powerful, and they have that sort of unchanging vibrational hum that I was just describing. And that power, that's actually a power that you have in you. And it's, I give it sort of two names in the book. I call it the feeling mass and the inner starseed. That's the title of the DVD I've made as well. And I call it the inner starseed because the feeling mass really is a sort of representation in you of the power that controls everything in the cosmos. You know, what makes the trees grow, what makes the stars turn, you know, spin around, and what makes people do whatever they do, and so forth. The birds fly. It's really the case, and you can see that when you contact this feeling state, when you have to learn how to sort of see it in you easily, almost on the spot at times. That's the best way. You know, that may take you a few weeks or something. A lot of times people just give up right away. Maybe it'll take you a week. Maybe it'll take you a month to learn how to do this. The rewards are so huge, you know, you might as well take the time to do it. And when you get in touch with it, you almost can just sense, you just almost kind of know that this feeling state is the same, it's the real energy behind things. Like, you've got a big piece of knowledge here. You've really discovered something large. You've got a taste of, you know, the ultimate metaphysical base to things. And whether it's, you know, where it comes from is another question. Does it come from God? Is it just part of the universe? And not have much to do with being directly connected to God at all moments? You know, there's interesting questions you can ask about that. But again, to get back to the point, it's, the listeners have to know that it's really sort of easy to, if you just take a little bit of time, when you finally contact it and start to feel the state in you, you'll say to yourself, wow, that was easy. Why didn't I just know how to do this all along? It's just, you have to sort of undo a lot of the surface consciousness and get under the surface just a little bit. And when you do, it's a very pleasant state to exist in. Again, and at first this is really important. When I first learned about it, it appeared as that tension that I described a second ago. But at the center of the tension is real bliss and ecstasy. And to be able to do telemeditation proficiently, mm-hmm. you have to find great happiness in it. It can't be work. It can't be...
It's got to come naturally, right?
Yeah, it has to be something that's fun to you. I mean, most people listening right now know that when something's not fun, most likely, unless you have to do it to get a paycheck or something, you're probably not going to keep it up. So you have to make sure that telemeditational work is very enjoyable to you. And the only way to do that is to get into this feeling mass state, because the feeling mass state is just, it's to some degree or another, whether extremely intense or just slightly, it's peaceful. Whether intense piece or slight piece, and it's very rewarding, and you'll want to go back. In the book I described it as like an inner temple. It's a little safe and secret place you can run to, whether you're in the middle of a crowd of people or by yourself in the forest or whatever. It's just a little sanctuary you can go to, and that's really what it feels like. Because when you're running around and doing whatever you're doing in your life, and then you run to this little sacred place inside you, it really feels like you've escaped, because all of a sudden a lot of your concerns have gone and you just feel satisfied and at peace and so forth. And you can imagine, if you have a place like that in you and you can locate this in you and go back to it whenever you need to, you're going to want to keep doing it. And then there's an added bonus here, that's the telementational place. And the way you do telementation is you learn to really live with that feeling, whenever get to it whenever you want to. This feeling mass, this deep hum, this deep tension, vibrational feeling within you. What you do is you put a state of pure knowingness, is what I call it in the book. It's not a belief. Belief is sort of something I'm against in the book, Telementation. It's you convince yourself that something is true. It's to such a degree that you just know it's the case. And you would never, you've tricked yourself so much into believing that whatever target or whatever you want to be manifested in reality, you just convince yourself that it's true. So you don't really believe that it's true. You know that it's true. And if you can feel yourself knowing it that much, mm-hmm. it will manifest in reality. And you can get pretty good at it where it can happen pretty fast.
But if you doubt for a moment, it won't happen, will it?
Well, yes, doubt is, that's like the big enemy of all this. But
that's
if
right.
you do, it's no big deal. Just start over. And in 5 seconds, you can be right again on the right. I mean, 10 minutes of doubt is much, much weaker than 5 seconds of intense telementational focus. So, I wouldn't worry too much about that. I know you're not suggesting, George, that it's some big problematical issue. But the point is just to keep going, because you'll get into the telementational mode more and more as you do it, and doubts and so forth will become easier to deal with. And once you see it happen, I think I described this early in the book, once you do, I suggest in the book to start off with little teeny targets, try to get your daughter to clean up her room or something, something much less extreme than world peace or something like that. Because once you see it happen once, your faith will be just a huge, and your doubts will just fade away so much more than what they were before you saw it happen. And you'll just start to know that it's going to work. You'll know that if you get in this state of feeling and knowing, that there's no question, it'll just happen. So, doubt can just fade away pretty easily.
Can you get into that state, Jeff, to heal yourself if you're sick?
Yeah, actually, I need to do that. As I'm sitting here talking here, I noticed I got out of class tonight after teaching, and I got in the car and I noticed my allergies were acting up. So that, yeah, that's the
good old Michigan allergy, huh?
Oh yeah, yeah. Holistic medicines haven't worked. Nothing works. So the only thing I'll have that has worked for me is just to do some telementation. So yeah, it's the best medicine. I'm not suggesting that you don't keep up with the alternative medicines and so forth. But yeah, if you we all know about the placebo effect, right, George? I mean, that's telementational work happening without people even knowing they're doing it. You give the sugar pill to half the people that have the disease, and then you give the medication to the other half, and the people on the sugar pill who are tricked into thinking they're taking medicine get healed even better than the people taking the medication.
Which I think is a good thing. If you don't have to take medicine and you can still heal yourself, whether you think it's a pill or not, go for it.
Yep. Yep, absolutely. Another big issue with telementation is that people talk about a lot is uncontrolled thoughts. And that is a big deal. I know the people that wrote the book, The Secret, talk a lot about it. And I do a little bit in my book. Basically what I say in the book.
What do you mean by uncontrolled thoughts?
Okay.
Are these bad things that pop into your head and pop out again?
I specifically mean visualization. You know how your thought, your consciousness has feelings, thoughts, you know, that little verbal talk inside you, and then visualizations.
Yes.
You know, if I
let me ask you this, Jeff. I mean, you know how everybody has been mad enough in their life, they've thought to themselves, I'm going to kill you. Now, 99.9% of us will never do that. But right. You think that. You're so ticked off, you think that. Is that part of what you mean?
No, not exactly. What I mean is if I say to everybody right now, don't think about a butterfly. Every single person listening, 2 million people or whatever listening, just thought of a butterfly. Okay, and the reason is because you can't control those thoughts, the specific aspect of thought called visualization. Okay, now our thought, the little verbal part of us, that's easy to control. Our feelings, those are kind of easy to control too. But the visualization part is wildly out of control. And if you just, another thing I suggest about telemeditation is do it with your eyes open so you can subdue the visualization part because you can't control it. So you don't want to get in this deep state where you've got the feeling mass doing its thing and you're in a state of knowingness. And you don't want to have a visualization pop in your mind of something that you don't want to happen. Because if you do that, it could be the case that it's manifested. That's happened to me before.
It's the old jury disregard what you just heard. Now, you know they can't.
Yeah. well, I mean, I don't think it's the visualization part that's doing the manifesting. I think it's the feeling mass is, but if you couple the feeling mass to something, the feeling mass will direct reality in that direction. So really what I've thought, the cure for uncontrolled thoughts, which is such a huge issue again with law of attraction studies, is abandon all visualization from your law of attraction telemeditation work. Now, I know the people that wrote The Secret, say to do visualization. That's fine. They've got a different take on it than I do. What I say is just keep the verbal thought talk part of you and combine that with a feeling mass, and then it's almost impossible with those two things to have an uncontrolled thought or feeling come into your consciousness, so you won't manifest something that you don't want to manifest. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, but a lot has to do with, I think, the manifestation of the mind and how strong you are and what you can create. Tell me a little bit about some of the experiments that were associated with the telemeditation.
Well, telemeditation, that word comes from a book called Mind Power by William Atkinson, who's an old, really interesting old writer. And back in those days, things like parapsychology and telemeditation or what's called telekinesis is what they called it. Those things were studied in the universities, and you could verify that all these things really happened, were really part of us. And that sort of lost favor, in the 40s and 50s when sort of more big money academia took over. But interestingly, there are straightforward studies that are so easy to do that, any one of you could do them in your basement, for example, to verify that our minds can influence reality telekinetically. That means, without just the power of the mind itself can do things. One good experiment that was done is, I think it was Vasiliev, a Russian scientist. I think there's a number of books that discuss it. I think a lot of Broad's books, like Distant Mental Influence, describes it. I think Diane Hennessy Powell's book, ESP Enigma, actually, I think I remember the page number, I think it's in the 90s, 92 or something, discusses it. And what happened in that experiment, Vasily, this Russian scientist, what he would do is he would hook people's skin up to electrical activity detectors to detect the conductivity of someone's skin, because if you have changes in emotion, you can measure that in the skin conductivity. So what he would do is then he would have one person hooked up to these apparatuses, and then he'd have another person. He would just tell them, okay, just try to will this person to have their emotional state change. He wouldn't give them any instruction. He would just say, just do it. And they would, in various ways, whatever their techniques, they would try to get to happen, and it would happen. He could repeat it over and over and over. That's one issue. There's many experiments like that where you can verify that your feelings are, in some way, you know, your mind's power is reaching out into reality and influencing it. So if we can verify that this is real, George, think of how much most of us have been sort of betrayed. You know, we've been told that we're just a Darwinian animal, and there's not a whole lot special about us. But here, all these experiments have been around, you know, and recorded, you know, 80 years ago in some cases, 100 years ago actually in some cases. And this is just shocking that, I mean, I bet even a lot of people just listening to this radio show right now, you still can't, you've been so conditioned to think that you're just like a cog in the machine, or, you know, you've got an idea of yourself. You're a Darwinian animal or a factory worker or a doctor, whatever. No, all those things don't matter. What you really are is this enormously powerful set of conscious states, which we're just starting to grasp. I mean, it's almost like the American Indians knew, you know, a lot about this power, and a lot of the old Buddhists knew about these powers, but they've forgotten. And the keys to our happiness and feeling peace, I mean, there's so much tension and so forth out there. The keys to us feeling peace and whatnot is found in, you know, what these experiments show. And so, I mean, it's important to have experiments show us this, because a lot of people won't believe it. I mean,
But we know, Jeff, we believe, especially, you know, people with your kind of background, you believe in telepathy and intuitiveness and psychic ability, you know, and I do too. And I don't know why so many mainstream scientists just kind of poo-poo the idea. They don't believe it.
Well, in academia, you know, the scientists don't, I mean, I know you know a lot of this, George, but a lot of the scientists don't, well, I think almost most of them don't choose their research. You know, you ever seen a professor out there, you know, stressing to get a grant. They've got, you know, so what are they doing when they do that? They're trying to write up a proposal to submit to the National Science Foundation or somebody to get money to conduct their laboratory.
Yeah.
So in other words, they have to write it up so that the higher powers with the money approve. So if you've got a professor at MIT who's, you know, writing to the National Science Foundation saying, I want to do experiments on telepathy, well, in the corporatist system that we live in, that's probably not going to fly.
That'll be on the bottom of the list, right?
Yeah, right. And the guys who are, you know, saying, I want to do my nuclear weapons research, they're going to get money thrown at them every direction.
Exactly. I've come up with a new internet. They'll get the cash. Stay with us, Jeff. We're already at the top of the hour. How quickly time flies. Jeff Grupp with us. His website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie, back with more on Coast to Coast AM.